where we've imposed conservation of energy. We've assumed the standard model particles are in equilibrium. We've assumed that there's no time reversal violation. So were there any questions people had about? Yes,
so we know that the standard model is CP bound.
Yes.
And therefore time bound. Mm-hmm. And you said that, but those effects are higher order? Is that?
That's right. So the simplest answer, and I think we'll talk about this when we talk about baryogenesis, is that CP violation comes in through complex phases in your Lagrangian. And so when I compute the absolute value of a matrix element, if I only have one term, then this is just real. So in order to have non-zero CP violation, you have to have interference between different terms. And that interference need to have relative phase. So it needs to have one phase that switches sign under CP conjugation, which are like the phases that appear in your Lagrangian. And you need a phase that doesn't change sign, say the imaginary part of a propagator or something related to propagation where your energy is fixed to be positive. So all of these things are higher order in perturbation theory. So it's generally true, but like in the standard model of anything, we don't have enough CP violation to have very appreciable consequences. I mean, it's large in that there's a large CP violating parameter, but in order to influence physical processes, we know that you have to have three generations of quarks to have CP violation, and so you need to go through all of the different quark generation you call a coupling, so you're suppressed by huge mixing angle fractions. So to a reasonably good approximation. I mean, if you wanted to be careful, then you could put a sort of, the way that you would do it is that you would divide your m squared into a CP odd and CP even part, and so you'd have the forward process would be 1 plus epsilon m squared, and the backward process would be 1 minus epsilon m squared. And then you could just do everything that we're doing. That's good. So are there any other questions about it? Okay. So this equation is already in a more manageable form. So what we're doing is we took the matrix element for our process. You square it, an average over all the spins. And then we're integrating it over all of the different momentum distributions. The idea being that for chi-chi to f-f production, we sum over the final state f momenta and do a thermal average over the chi momenta, and then we do the reverse for the inverse process. Okay, so this, it's looking better, but we still have an integral over 4 times 3, so 12 different variables. And this thing simplifies a lot when you do various integrations over the delta function, but we can express this in terms of quantities that we already understand. So I wrote up there a formula for the cross-section, which you can get from pretty much any QFT book. I think this is the form that is in Peskin and Schroeder, but what you see is that there are a lot of the same kinds of things that are showing up in your sigma. So you have integrals over Lorentz invariant phase space for your third and fourth particles. You have the delta function, you have a matrix element. So we can take all of these features and notice that the chi 1 and chi 2 distributions are independent of the f and the f bar distribution. So we can rearrange all of the things in the integrand so that we separate out the df and the df bar pieces. And then we can simply replace this integral with that definition of the cross section. Yeah.
Being pedantic, but yesterday you had factors of GI kicking around in the cross section formula because the phase space for cross section is slightly different than this GI normalized.
Yeah, so that may have been a mistake.
Okay.
So there are factors of G in that pi.
The one you showed.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe I had put the pi and the G's, and that's wrong. Okay, the factors of G are in the pi already. So this M squared is averaged over all spins.
Oh, right.
Okay. Normally when we compute a cross section, we don't have G and we sum over them. So of course, an average times G is just the sum over, states. Yeah. Yes.
The other thing is, the cross section expression we're using is from QFT at zero temperature.
That's right.
Here things are actually happening probably at non-zero temperature. Is that something we are concerned about, or?
So this is just a mathematical expression. So it's true. If I were to tell you that right-hand side was just a cross section, that's wrong, right? But the finite temperature effects are all incorporated in these thermal distributions. Okay. Yeah. That's right. So all we're saying is that this looks exactly like something I've already calculated, so I may as well substitute it in. Okay. So if we do that, then we end up with our collision term. So we're going to sub in the definition of sigma. And what we end up with is, so these n's are functions of temperature, but not momenta, so I can pull them out of the integral. So I get minus n chi squared minus n chi equilibrium squared. Okay. Then I still have my integrals over chi 1 and chi 2. Then I have 4 e chi 1 e chi 2 times sigma v times f chi 1. Okay, so basically I've just done the integrals over two of the variables. And I'm left with this expression, which suddenly looks a lot better, especially in light of the fact that this d pi has a factor of 1 over 2e in it. So this has a 1 over 2e1. This basically has a 2e1. These factors all cancel. And what I end up with is just something that's an integral over momentum. Okay. Okay, good. And this is something that we generally get when we solve the Boltzmann equation like this. Just if you take the general form of the Boltzmann equation and sub in the definition of a cross section, you always end up with something that looks like an average over the momenta of the initial states times sigma v times the thermal distributions of that. So this is very general. And because it's very general, to further simplify our life and be able to understand physically what's going on, we define something called a thermal average. Okay, the thermal average can apply to any function. So the thermal average of some function O defined as 1 over the equilibrium number densities of the, say, two initial states. So basically, I take whatever my function is, it's a function of, say, two momenta, I multiply them by the respective phase space distributions, I multiply them by the number of degrees of freedom, and then I integrate over momentum. Okay? And this is exactly what I have here. And you'll see that because of the way that we've, the cross section is defined, these are no longer Lorentz invariant integrals. These are just integrals over three momentum. But that's not a bad thing because by talking about a thermal bath, we're explicitly breaking Lorentz invariance anyway. We're saying there's some preferred frame where everything has a certain temperature associated with it. So we don't necessarily expect the thermal average to respect Lorentz invariance, even though the original expression that we started with seemed Lorentz invariant. And if you can check this, but if I just take the thermal average of, say, the identity operator, it's 1. So it's correctly normalized for an average. So if I now substitute this in, what I end up with for my Boltzmann equation is n chi dot plus 3h n chi is minus thermal average of sigma v times this difference between n chi and n chi equilibrium. And this is something that seems like a more reasonable equation. We have some hope of understanding what the solutions are too. Okay. Any questions about the steps that we just took? Okay. So before we go on to how you actually solve this in some more correct way, we can kind of get an estimate for what this equation is telling us about how the number density of chi changes. So we see that this equation looks sort of like n chi dot is equal to some number, here's some function here, times n chi, okay? Where this number, there are two different terms. One, where it looks like the Hubble scale, and one where it looks like n chi equilibrium sigma v. So I'm basically pulling an n chi out of each of these terms. And these two things are unrelated to one another. This is largely determined by the particle physics parameters. This is determined by the dynamics of the universe's expansion. And so a handy approximation to take is a sort of step function approximation where we consider one regime where one term is dominant, and then they sort of cross over, and you suddenly switch to the other one if it becomes larger. So we only ever consider one term at a time, and that allows us to at least get an estimate for what's happening. Okay, so let's assume at first that there isn't any dark matter. So it's out of equilibrium. This is a reasonable thing that we might want to check. You know, if this isn't part of the standard model, even though it has some interactions with it, we don't want to make any assumptions about whether it's in equilibrium or not. And so what happens to n chi depending on which of these two terms of the equation is dominating? So we'll start if the Hubble term is dominating. So this means that H is much larger than n times sigma v. So if the Hubble term is dominating, then the equation simplifies to n chi dot. It's minus 3 n chi. And this is, of course, just 0 because we don't actually have anything. So what this tells us is that if n chi is out of equilibrium and the expansion is happening more rapidly than whatever scattering processes are going on, then it stays out of equilibrium. You just never produce any of it.
That not kill the Hubble term?
That's what he showed. The third equality is
Hubble term pretty close. Okay, I see. Yeah. Sorry, I should specify this is at some specific initial time. And then we're evolving the equation forward. But of course, if n chi dot is 0 always, then you never actually evolve into anything other than 0. So basically, if expansion is faster than the chi chi FF bar scattering, or then the dynamics resulting from that, then n chi is just always 0. And this isn't totally surprising, because this is basically the same as if we just neglected the collision term in the first place, and we already looked yesterday at what that is. Now, what if we go the other way, and the collision dominates? So this is Hubble dominates. So if the collision term dominates, then we can write down n chi dot is minus sigma v. Okay. And without solving this explicitly, we can infer its behavior, namely that even if n chi is 0, this term here is non-zero, and it leads to production of chi. And in fact, n chi dot is generally going to be quite big unless this thing is small. So n chi dot is large unless chi is closest equilibrium value. So what you basically have is this attractor solution to the equation where you started off with nothing. And then if we plot t and n chi of t, you sort of end up with something that looks like this. So the basic story here is that if I start with something that is out of equilibrium and I add in some interactions with something that isn't equilibrium, then this term is going to pull that particle into equilibrium. Okay? Basically, the idea is that if you have lots of Fs, then the F bar can annihilate into chi, but the reverse process doesn't really happen. And so you just slowly fill up the chi distribution until it reaches what you would expect from thermal equilibrium. Okay, so this is a generic feature interactions bring pi into equilibrium. And again, it's not something that's totally surprising, but at least we can quantify exactly how it happens and what the relevant timescales over which it can happen. But what this suggests to us is that if dark matter has some kind of interaction with the standard model, then it's reasonable to assume that at some point in the earlier universe it was in thermal equilibrium, provided that the interactions are strong enough, and for many of the kinds of interactions we consider it is. Okay. So even though dark matter is dark now, it maybe wasn't so dark back in the early universe. Okay. So this two stages way of looking at the evolution turns out to be quite handy. So what we do is we define a quantity gamma, which is n chi sigma v. And this is the basically the rate of chi scattering, essentially. And so we see that we're in the Hubble dominated for gamma is much smaller than h, and we're in collision dominated for gamma much larger than h. So this provides us with some quite convenient way of just by calculating this quantity and saying what's the Hubble scale at that time, to figuring out are we in the regime where you're just expanding and there are no interactions, or are we in the regime where the reactions bring the thing into equilibrium. Okay, so this is fine. Let's say that I started off at time t0. I was in a limit where the collision terms began to dominate, and so I bring my chi into equilibrium. This sort of resets the initial condition. I don't care how much chi I started with. If I started from here or here or here, I always end up at the same solution. Okay, so coming into equilibrium, basically resets n chi to n chi equilibrium. Now I can ask, well, what happens at later times? Because I have this thing that's in equilibrium. And we saw yesterday that if something is in equilibrium and stays in equilibrium, then as, so this is at t smaller than its mass and t bigger than its mass, if it becomes non-relativistic, there's this exponential suppression of the number density, and then you're just not left with anything. So, okay, it's nice that it came into equilibrium so we have some dark matter, but then if it stays in equilibrium for too long, then it's not going to be dark matter. It can't possibly be enough of it to explain what's going on. So we can consider now taking our system n chi at some t1, which is an n chi equilibrium. And let's say that this is for temperatures that are bigger than or equal to m chi. What happens at later times? Okay, so if the temperature is larger than the mass, so then the number density is decreasing, but it's decreasing like the temperature cubed. It's basically being diluted by the Hubble expansion. But the idea is that everything is being diluted by the Hubble expansion, so you don't end up with relatively more or less chi's than you have anything else. And so if chi is scattering quickly enough to bring it into equilibrium, then it pretty generally just stays in equilibrium. There's no reason why anything should change at these later times. So so for t greater than or equal to m chi, chi stays in equilibrium. Okay. Now, however, as we continue to cool, t drops below m chi. So now my gamma, which is n chi sigma v, is proportional to e to the minus m chi over the temperature. And this is something that's falling very quickly. So my Hubble scale is still going like the scale factor to the power of 2. Now all of a sudden my rate is dropping exponentially quickly. So even if I start, if I plot gamma over h, I start out in this very, very high regime at early times, then at you know, when temperature is equal to m chi, this thing falls off. And eventually I cross sort of the magic threshold of one, where I consider that that the collision term no longer dominates over the Hubble expansion. And the basic idea for this is that when you're in this regime, chi-chi annihilation still proceeds perfectly fine, because f is lighter than chi, so chi annihilates into f. There's no reason why this can't happen. But if I consider the ff bar to chi-chi process, if this thing is heavier than that and the temperature of the universe drops below this mass, I just don't have enough kinetic energy in order to create chi. I need to look for these little fluctuations in the energy distribution that I momentarily have this huge amount of energy that allows me to produce the chi. And so this leads to this rapidly falling exponential factor. So if I run out of chi's, then eventually it becomes harder for these two guys to find each other and annihilate. And so at a certain point, there are few enough of them that they just don't find each other anymore. And that's what happens when the Hubble expansion kicks in. Okay, so let's call this t f0. So we have these different time scales. There's the time that you start at, where it's in equilibrium. Then there's the time where the temperature is equal to the mass. And then we have this later time where gamma and Hubble are equal to one another. Okay. So at this magic time, we switch back to the Hubble solution. So but we're in this collision-dominated regime where n chi was basically equal to n chi equilibrium. And now all of a sudden, we're going to switch back to Hubble. Okay, so we know that n chi at t frees out is approximately n chi equilibrium at t frees out. That's just what we found over there. But now at later times, we can ignore collisions. And so we're just left with some number density of things that is diluted by the expansion. And so we go back to our normal result that you found in the tutorial, that the number density scales like the number at t frees out times the scale factor over the scale factor at t frees out to the -3. So the way that the thermal history goes is that you started out with no chi, it was brought into equilibrium, and then when it hits its mass, as soon as it hits its mass, the equilibrium number density starts falling, and it tracks it as far as it can. But then at a certain point, it just can't follow this exponential falling anymore. Okay? This is when there aren't enough chi's left for the annihilation to stay rapid. So what's strange about this picture is that you can have interactions that are in equilibrium, but at a certain point, you just can't maintain equilibrium because the number density is too suppressed. And what you end up with is some sort of what we call a relic, some number of chi's that's just around, and then it just continues to stay around. It's diluted by the expansion of the universe, but it just stays here. It doesn't go to zero exponentially like you would expect. Ross, yes?
Saying that it's around the mass of the dark, like when the temperature reaches the mass of the dark matter, that's when it's going to, it's still in equilibrium, but that's where the number density starts to fall off a lot. But couldn't the rate just be decreasing a lot with temperature so that it becomes a lot smaller than the Hubble expansion? Like, does the mass really play an important role? Can you have relativistic matter freeze out?
You can have relativistic matter freeze out, and that's what happens with neutrinos. But as you can see in the case of the neutrinos, as the students will show in their tutorial today, the neutrinos scatter through the weak interactions, WZ. The mass of this is about 100 GeV, and the freeze-out temperature of the neutrinos is about an MeV. So there's a huge separation that you need in scales in order to have something that's relativistic freeze out. So it can happen, but the reason for this is that an exponential falls much faster than a power law. And this thing goes like a power law in temperature, and this thing goes like an exponential. The Hubble scale is actually quite small, usually, at around the weak scale. It's like 10 to the minus 14 GeV. Okay. So you can have things freezing out for a variety of reasons, but if you have something that's heavy, this is the most efficient way for it to decouple. Okay. And as we'll see, this happens generically with things that you might expect to add to the standard model for other reasons. So in some ways, thermal freezeout isn't something that you necessarily want to have happen. It's something that just comes out of your theory. If I tell you a mass and an interaction strength, I'm left with a relic abundance. There's just no choice about that. And in fact, this can play a very strong constraint on models, where if I write a model and it gives me too much dark matter, that model is basically ruled out, unless I can find some way of tweaking it. Okay. So if we revert to our yield notation, what this is basically telling us is that for y chi larger than this chi, the relative number density of chi is just a constant compared to everything. Okay, so this is what we call a thermal relic. And the process is called thermal freezeout. And this generally happens when you have some new heavy particle that you add to your theory. Right? So then the question is, how much of it do you have? Does it either violate a constraint? Does it give you the right amount of dark matter, et cetera, et cetera? But what's interesting about it is that the particle physics cross-section comes into the thing that determines whether it's in or out of equilibrium. So depending on what its interaction properties are, it changes when it freezes out and how much it is. Of it there is. And it turns out there's a very direct relationship, which we're going to derive in a few moments. So are there any questions about the thermal relic story? Okay. So the next part, we want to actually solve the Boltzmann equation. Okay, so we have this formula. Now, conceptually, this notation is actually the best to understand what's going on. Because as we see, you can directly say, okay, I'm going to compare the size of Hubble to the cross-section times the number density. I can make a very clear comparison. What's not nice about this n chi is that it's also factoring in simultaneously Hubble expansion and collision processes. And so in this limit that we've been looking at, it's OK because we can kind of set one of the terms to 0 and then just solve a single term differential equation. But this whole differential equation is in generally somewhat complicated. So for the purposes of doing an actual calculation, you want to change variables to the yield that we defined. So we want to use this. So this is what we're going to use in place of our chi number density. And it also turns out that instead of using time, time is a variable that doesn't really have a whole lot of meaning to us. Because we see that the relevant scales are actually when the temperature is equal to the mass. That's the time that we care about. And when I say, OK, well, if I have 100 GeV particle, at what time does that happen? Like, I don't know what time that happens at. So it's actually easier instead to convert to keeping track of things as a function of temperature, and in particular, a form of dimensionless temperature. So we also define this variable x, which is m chi over the temperature. So we see that m chi equal to the temperature is just x equals 1. So this, it sort of immediately zooms us into, around x's of 1 is where all the interesting physics is happening. And it allows us to collect all of our dimensionful scales and sort of lump them together. And the evolution is strictly in terms of the dimensionless property. Okay? So since freeze-out is happening around x equals order 1 to 10 or so, and a little bit higher than that, but this is definitely the most reasonable thing to do. Okay? So in a homework question, you'll do the change of variables in order to convert this equation. So I'll just tell you what the new form of the equation is. It's dy dx minus x, the entropy, over the Hubble scale where I've taken the temperature and evaluated it at m chi. Okay. So as you can see, it's not a as obvious here that there, so you have this ratio of something that looks like a ray over a Hubble scale, but computationally it's easier because we've taken our three terms in this equation, converted them into two, and you see that the important thing of the number density being driven to equilibrium is still very manifest in this form, okay? But it just cleans things up a little, and especially if you're using like Mathematica to solve it, it's never really going to solve this, but it might have some chance of solving that. Okay, so we know what the equilibrium number distributions of these things are. We can just use our formula for n and for s. However, one thing that we don't know is what is this sigma v? I mean, I know that it's the cross-section after I do a thermal averaging, but in general, it's kind of a nasty thing that you have to do because these things are exponentials. This is typically some rational function of the momenta. And so at the very best, I'm going to end up with a whole bunch of Bessel functions and things. And at worst, it's going to be an integral I have to do numerically. So this is generally something that you do numerically. But, and if you're doing something complicated, then you really need to track everything. However, since we've looked at this physical picture of what's going on, we notice that what we really care about is all happening here in this t is less than m chi regime. Okay? And so since chi is non-relativistic, this means that the velocity is small. It turns out it's not too small. It's like 0.2 or something. It frees out. But the expansion, it turns out, that you do on sigma v is quadratic in velocity at leading order. So what we can do is we can do a non-relativistic expansion. So if I compute sigma v without thermal averaging, that's just the same thing that you do in particle physics. And then I sub in p1 is m chi 1 plus u squared over 2, 0, 0, chi u. The second one is just the same thing. Now, technically, these things are going to be moving in all kinds of different directions, but the CM frame is good enough for this approximation. Okay. So I'm basically just writing the four momenta in terms of some small velocity associated with this particle. Then what I can do, so this is, I'm defining this velocity u just so because sigma v is something that notationally we consider as kind of a one entity. And so I'll call the velocity of this guy u. Then I can just do a Taylor series expansion. What I find is that sigma v is some constant times some other constant u squared plus, you know, order u to the fourth stuff. And this helps, and these a and b are independent of momentum. These are just constants. So this is nice because I have this complicated thermal average that I have to do, but now I'm really only doing the thermal average over this velocity piece. This is the only momentum dependent part. U is sort of defined implicitly this way. It's just the velocity of each particle. So I'm just saying, okay, momentum non-relativistically is m times the velocity. And then I'm doing a non-relativ, this is just the mass energy plus mv squared over 2. So it's like Newtonian mechanics. And which I can do because it's all non-relativistic. And this u squared is typically about 0.1 or maybe a bit smaller. So this is a pretty decent expansion. So what I do is I do this expansion, I keep to leading order, and then I use the fact that the average value of 1 is 1. The average value of u squared, which is an instructive thing to derive for yourself.
Could you not write the corners very hard to
see? Oh, yeah, of course. Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll move this up. Okay, so we're taking thermal averages. So the thermal average of 1 is 1. Thermal average of u is 3 over 2x, and that's just something you can calculate. So instead of doing the full calculation, I can approximate sigma v by a plus 3b over 2x plus dot, dot, dot. So I don't actually have to do those extra integrals, which is nice. And typically, we keep only the leading order piece. So if I calculate A and it's 0, then I have to go to the B piece. But if it's not 0, then it's usually fine to just keep that. Now, these pieces have special names. The A piece, we refer to it as the S-wave component. And B, refer to it as the P-wave component. This is because they're related to some decomposition in terms of angular momentum states. In particular, usually if things are annihilating non-relativistically, if they can annihilate without having, so basically if they can annihilate at zero momentum, they will, because that's sort of the dominant process that's happening. But sometimes angular momentum forbids that. For instance, if I have particles with spin annihilating to particles without spin, then I might go from some net angular momentum state of 1 to an intrinsic spin state of 0. And so the only way I can conserve angular momentum is if these things are moving relative to each other. So there are various physical reasons why you can have an S wave or a P wave dominating. But usually we consider, if something can go through this, has a non-zero A, then that's going to be the largest component. So in solving our equation, then, we can solve it pretty generally by just keeping the leading order piece. So we do this expansion of sigma v, where n is 0 or 1 or whatever the leading piece is. And then I can just sub it into my equation. So instead of putting sigma v, I plug this in. And turns out I can sort of group a bunch of the constants together. I'll extract the x dependence. So the entropy goes like t cubed. So it goes like x to the minus 3. So by combining all of these things along with that x, I get an x to the power of n minus 2. Where I've defined lambda as this combination of things. Okay, and that's just so I don't have to keep dragging around my thermal cross section. Okay, so I guess sigma v at x equals 1 is just sigma n. Okay, so it's just a bunch of numbers. This thing, by the way, this is actually just proportional to gamma over h at x equals 1. Because this x has the temperature dependence you normally expect for the number density. Okay, so in order to get a solution to this, it's still going to be difficult to solve this equation in its complete generality. And so we still split it into two different regions. We solve the equation in each region and then match it. Yes?
Does lambda have an index, or is there a sum? Or
there's no sum. N is the biggest of...
Oh, I see. The leading order.
Yeah, so we're taking the leading order in this expansion. So if this is my x, then here's where gamma is equal to h. So I'm going to call this x freeze out. So x, because it goes like 1 over temperature, gets bigger as time goes on. So this is sort of like a time variable. So I start out with chi in equilibrium when gamma is bigger than h. And I end up with chi out of equilibrium, which is when gamma is smaller than h. And when chi is in equilibrium, by definition, what it means is that the number density of chi is essentially the same as its equilibrium number density. Whereas when it's out of equilibrium, we found that it's a thermal relic, and so its number density is much bigger than its equilibrium number density. This is some falling exponential, and it kind of plateaus out. Okay. So because the key thing that differentiates these regimes is what y chi is doing relative to y chi equilibrium, I can define this quantity delta, which is the number of chi's minus the number of chi's in equilibrium. And in this regime, delta is going to be small. And here, delta is going to be large. So I basically take my equation, write it in terms of delta, and I can do various expansions on it. Okay. So let's call this 1, call this 2. So in regime 1, my delta and delta primes are small. So if I write out my equation now in terms of delta, then I can drop various terms that compare delta to other things. So for instance, I can drop this term, I can drop this term, which makes for a pretty easy differential equation for delta. And so what I end up with is delta is basically the derivative of y chi equilibrium, or y chi equilibrium. Okay. So this is my solution when chi is in equilibrium. And I've been implicitly assuming that that in this regime, chi is approximately in equilibrium, so its departure from equilibrium is small. So we want to check, is this self-consistent? Is this delta actually small? Okay. And it turns out that it is. The reason is that in this regime, this is some exponential, approximately. So y chi prime is essentially also, and you know, this is the minus x. This is also goes like e to the minus x. So these two terms are of the same order of magnitude. And so what I'm left with is something that's 1 over lambda. And lambda is what I'm using to define my ratio of interaction strength to the Hubble expansion. So this thing is very small, 1, if lambda is very big. So basically, just assuming that I have rapid scattering is enough to show me that, yes, this is, I have a very small departure from equilibrium, and this quantifies exactly what my departure from equilibrium is in this regime. Okay. Now you can say, well, why is there even a small departure from equilibrium? The reason is that if I look at this equation, if y chi was exactly equal to y chi equilibrium, then my derivative would be 0. Okay. But I do know that my y chi equilibrium is changing in time. It's changing like this exponential factor. So what I need is I need these two things to be slightly offset from one another so that y chi essentially continues to track y chi equilibrium all the way down. Okay. So there's always a small departure from equilibrium just from the fact that the universe is expanding. The question is whether that's significant or not. Okay. So in the second regime, I make the opposite expansion. Now, delta is going to be much bigger than y chi equilibrium, and it's going to be comparable to y chi. So just plugging in, I can neglect all the terms that are proportional to y chi equilibrium, and I just get a very simple differential equation that I can integrate. So when I integrate this, this just gives me, so I'm going to integrate from x equals x freeze out to infinity. Okay? Because once I go out of equilibrium, I stay in out of equilibrium forever. And this is what I got. Whoops. Yes.
Oh, did you say that?
Is it, are you saying delta is a constant? I mean, x3.
Oh, sorry.
Delta at x infinity. Yeah, sorry, I've done the integral. Yeah, that's sloppy notation on my part. Okay. So delta at x infinity, this is equal to y minus y equilibrium, which is just y at x of infinity. So this tells me my my thermal relic abundance. Now, there's something that I've done that's a little bit cheap, which is that, OK, I've given you this thermal relic abundance, but in terms of this parameter x freeze out, but I haven't told you what x freeze out is. Right? I know that it happens somewhere around when gamma is equal to h. This is sort of a weakness of solving the equation with this approach. But what I can do is I'll say, OK, well, I'll take an estimate for gamma freeze out is when gamma of x freeze out is equal to h of x freeze out. This is sort of my estimate of it. And if I do this, I end up with something that's kind of horrible, but it's log where this argument is the same argument that's in this log. So basically, I end up with an equation. You know, this gamma is proportional to n, which has an e to the minus x in it. So I have some e to the minus x's, and I have some x's. So what I do is you solve this equation iteratively. You plug in, and you take the log, and then you reinsert that equation back in. And this is horrible. But there's one nice thing, two nice things that we can see about it. One is that x depends logarithmically on pretty much everything. So what this means is, even if I change my cross-section by 10 orders of magnitude, my x changes by a factor of, like, I don't know, 5 or 10 or something. Not even a factor, just that number. So because it has a logarithmic dependence, x freeze out is almost always between 20 and, say, 35. Just always. Okay? And the reason why it's big is because there's an M Planck in there. So a log of M Planck automatically gives you some big number. Yes?
Sorry, I missed the definition of x
infinity. That's just x at time equals infinity.
Oh.
So that's today, basically. Sometimes it's referred to as x naught, but that's also sometimes the initial time. So it's kind of confusing. OK, so because there's this very mild logarithmic dependence, even though I was kind of sketchy in how I defined my x, it doesn't actually matter, because it's always I'm always going to be right to within one or two. And so I'm going to get qualitatively the same answer. And really, if you want to be right to within better than an order of magnitude, you actually have to do the full numerical integration anyway. There isn't really any other way around it. Okay. What was the other? And then the second thing is that x is bigger than 1 because of this M Planck. And so this justifies our velocity expansion. So basically, this is telling us that chi really is quite non-relativistic at the time that it's freezing out. Okay. Okay. So I have this expression for y. Y at time infinity. Okay, but we know what lambda is because we express lambda in terms of these various constants. So I can just put my lambda back in. What I end up with is some constant times n plus 1. So this is what my final abundance is. And what's really interesting is that y of t of infinity is inversely proportional to the annihilation cross-section. This is telling me that what my particle physics is telling me about the cross section has a direct link between how much of chi I have at late times. It basically goes like 1 over this value. So if I have a larger cross section, the interaction rate is higher and I freeze out later. So you have this interesting opposite relationship between the stronger it interacts and the less of it you end up with. Okay? And you can even do a bit better if I calculate the energy density for chi. This is just, it's non-relativistic, so its energy is mostly in its mass. Then this is equal to the same constant times x freeze out to some order 10 number times the entropy today, because this n chi is y chi times the entropy. So that's just some fixed thing over m Planck sigma n.
Wait, so does that make your formula for y? Oh, no.
Right, so I multiply by m chi. So it's what's even more remarkable about this is that the energy that I have in chi is independent of its mass. Okay? It's a really shocking result, because what this is telling me is that no matter what the mass of my particle is, if I have the same cross section, I get the same energy abundance. And this turns out to be hugely helpful because we've actually measured the dark matter fraction. This is rho dark matter over rho critical. This is about 0.265 or so. And so if I want omega chi to be equal to omega dark matter, then, let me just write this. Let me just convert rho chi to omega chi by dividing by the critical density. It's just some numerical factors. Then this, it's just some number over sigma v. So if I want, if I put these two things together, I find a number for the cross section. So this is pretty remarkable. We've taken some cosmological fact, just the amount of dark matter we have, and then I gave you a particle, and I said it interacts with a certain strength, and the theory just told me how strongly it has to interact if I want this particle to be dark matter. In particular, I've gone from something that doesn't necessarily have any intrinsic scale, like there's no dependence on the mass of chi, and it's picked out a scale for me. It's just told me what my interaction rate has to be. In other units, this is, you'll also see this expressed in terms of this as a cross section. This is just found by multiplying by various powers of h bar and c, to convert coordinates. So this is great, because we now have a very definitive benchmark that's independent of the mass of the particle, that if I'm writing down a theory that is going to tell me what dark matter is, then this is what I'm aiming for. And so I want my theory to give me this number for the cross-section. So in the last few minutes, we're going to talk about something called the Wimp miracle, where we're actually going to estimate what are the particle physics parameters that give me that cross-section. So as the simplest thing I can think of, can everyone see this part? Okay. I'm not going to add in any new forces. So I know that dark matter can't interact through the strong force, and it can't interact through electromagnetically. But I haven't said anything about the weak force. So I'm just going to add chi to the standard model, and it's going to interact by the weak force. So then, what is m chi to give the thermal cross section, this 2 times 10 to the minus 9? So, what I'm going to be thinking about are processes that look sort of like this. I have chi and a chi bar coming in. They're going to annihilate through a Z boson. They're going to annihilate to an F and an F bar. Now you might be wondering how in 5 minutes we're going to calculate what sigma V is. And the answer to this is that for most dark matter theories, we don't have enough of a handle on them. You know, I have these whole new other particles. They could, in principle, have different couplings. We don't know what their masses are. So it's usually sufficient to just give an estimate of what the cross-section is. Because I could go through all of this work and set up my numerical integration, and then I find out that I'm 10 orders of magnitude off. And so that was a big waste of time. And there are always going to be little tricky factors of 2 everywhere. But because of the fact that this x is pretty much only logarithmically dependent on the mass and the scale, I can always assume that the freeze-out is going to be around x equals 30. And so I can just sort of plug in some numbers and get an idea of what's happening. Okay. So the trickiest thing that I have to do is to estimate the cross-section. So how do I estimate the cross-section? It turns out that the best way to do it is through a combination of dimensional analysis plus power counting of the coupling. So let me illustrate. First, for this process, I want to do dimensional analysis. What I really want is a cross-section, or a cross-section times velocity. Now, I'm using natural units. So in natural units, energy is dimensions of length inverse, is dimensions of time inverse. So v, which is centimeters per second, is dimensionless in this. So I need to only worry about sigma. Cross-section is an area, so it's length squared. So cross-section goes like energy to the minus 2. So I can just ask myself, in my problem, what has dimensions of energy? So what has dimensions of energy? Well, there's the mass of chi, there's the mass of the z, mass of F, and there's the temperature. Those are the only things that I have in my problem. Okay. Now, we assumed at the very beginning of this calculation that m chi is bigger than mf. So we assumed. Okay. So m chi is always going to dominate over mf. Because I'm going to end up with 1 over some combination of masses squared, it's always going to be picked out by the biggest one. So we want to find the biggest one. So this is not the biggest one. This freezes out when it's non-relativistic. So by definition, m chi is bigger than t. So this is also not the one we want. Now, there's some question of what the relative size of m chi and mz are. But I'm going to assume that m chi is bigger than mz. You could assume the other way and then do the estimate that way and compare your answer. So this is sort of an ad hoc assumption, but we can see if it's consistent. So we're going to pick this m chi. So we know right away that sigma is proportional to 1 over m chi squared. B, power counting. So it's probably worth reviewing this if you don't remember, but in general, when I draw Feynman diagrams, I end up with something called a coupling constant at each vertex. Okay? So what I do is I say, okay, well, my matrix element is proportional to gz squared. When I take the rate, I square the matrix element. So power counting tells me that this is proportional to gz to the fourth for m chi squared. And then finally, I'm going to add in something that's called a phase space factor. And this basically just comes from the fact that when I actually compute a cross-section, I'm doing integrals over things that have 1 over 2 pi cubes and 2 pi squared. Yes?
Do we know that the coupling to chi is going to be the same as the coupling to F?
We don't.
We just going to assume that's the same.
OK, so yeah, so good. So let's be careful about it.
And we'll call them 2 different things. Now, to actually say anything quantitative will have to be in the limit where the couplings are the same. Okay. But that's a very good point. So basically, I'm doing integrals over things that have suppressions by powers of pi. And so I usually just add in a fudge factor. I usually add in a 1 over 8 pi. You can also add a 1 over 4 pi or a 1 over 16 pi. You know, these all differ by factors of 2. And our answers are going to be off by a factor of 2 anyway. But the point is that 1 over 8 pi or 4 pi or 16 pi, these are all suppressions by about an order of magnitude. And so if you really want to be within an order of magnitude, you should include something like this. Okay. Normally, you get a 1 over 16 pi, and then your velocity factor when you multiply gives you a factor of 2. But so that's why I like 1 over 8 pi. So I can just write this down. This is approximately gz chi squared, gv f squared over 8 pi m chi squared. And now I can just plug in. So if I make the assumption that gz chi is equal to gz f, then this is just a number that's about 0.7 or so. Yes?
Sorry, why did you set your velocity to order 1 when we are assuming the particles are not relativistic?
Oh.
Because sigma has a 1 over v. So this is assuming S wave dominance. So remember, we do the velocity expansion on sigma v, not on sigma. So sigma v can be independent of velocity. Right? So if I look at my expression for cross-section up there, I have a 1 over v. Yeah. So if I have a P wave process, then this will probably be down by about an order of magnitude. But again, you know, you try to get all the factors you can, but you know, at a certain point, we just want to get an estimate of it. So if I set these two couplings to be the same, then what I end up with is so just plugging in the numbers, I find that I get the thermal cross-section when I have a coupling of about 0.6, and I have a mass of about a TeV. Right? So what this is telling me is that if I add a new particle that interacts via the weak force and has a mass of TeV, I automatically get the dark matter abundance. And this is something that's called the WIMP miracle. WIMP stands for, I'm sorry, I know it's hard to read over here. This is a weakly interacting massive particle. And what's cool is that the TeV scale is already the scale of where the Higgs has its mass. I mean, plus or minus factors of a few. And now cosmology has also given us this same energy scale out, assuming that you're coupling through order one interactions. And so when people first calculated this, they said, oh, this is great. This means that all physics is going to be related to the Higgs or to this scale. And this is exactly the scale that's probed by the LHC and other experiments. So next time, we'll look at what the implications of this are. Yes?
Could we possibly see dark matter in LHC?
Yes. So that's one possible way. So the process where you have, you can start erasing that, I think. So if you have chi chi going to F bar, if these are quarks, then I can have QQ bar. I can produce this at the LHC. The problem is that this is invisible, right? So I don't see this. So if I just produce something that's invisible, that doesn't help me because, you know, I'll never know it was even there. So what I need to do is I need to radiate off something else so that my final state is something plus nothing going in the opposite direction. And that's a key signature of dark matter. Yeah. But there are a lot of experiments, probing this energy regime, partially because the WIMP story has gained so much traction. And so people are interested in looking for WIMPs. But as we'll see when we start looking at other experiments, this scenario is like very badly ruled out by other experiments. So it's great that it gives you the right relic abundance, but you need to be careful that, you know, if I have some new particle that's interacting with the weak force, I'm going to start seeing it scattering off of me in all kinds of ways. So, yeah, sorry.